Hello and welcome to CET in China, A Bridge to the Future, a special podcast series to commemorate CET's 30th anniversary in China. I'm David Moser, Academic Director at CET Beijing Chinese Studies. We're very pleased to have with us here on the first installment of the podcast a longstanding friend and supporter of CET, Professor Jeffrey Wasserstrom, Professor of History at the University of California at Irvine. Welcome to the podcast, Jeff.
It's great to be here.
And with us on the podcast today are four CET students currently in Beijing. We'll be getting to your questions in a minute, but first say ni hao to the audience.
Ni hao.
Ni hao.
As you can see, Jeff, they're all fluent in Chinese. So. I'd like to remind everyone that today is a very auspicious day to record this podcast because it happens to be Lei Feng Day in China. Do you all know who Lei Feng is, right? The Lei Feng, the perfect model citizen, good Samaritan, promoted by the party during the Mao era. And by the way, that jaunty music that we heard at the beginning of the podcast was from the 60s, I guess. But you could also hear it in the 80s when we were here, Jeff, with Xue Xi Lei Feng, Steady Lei Feng. And the government media has really pulled out all the stops on this, resurrecting the spirit of Lei Feng this year. And we'll be getting to that topic in a minute. But first, I want to clue the audience in a little bit about Jeff Wasserstrom, in case you haven't heard of him. Jeff is a sort of new hybrid academic scholar. He's a blogger. He created the blog China Beat. He's a frequent blogger with the Huffington Post. And he's an author of too many books to mention, but one that I'll mention is China in the 21st Century, What Everyone Needs to Know, a book that CET has used in the past and is using now and will use again. China in 2008, which was about the Olympic year. China's Brave New World, and many other books. So Google him or Amazon him or whatever verb you want to do to him to find out more about Jeff. All right, the theme of this podcast is the changes in the last 30 years in China, specifically with studying in China. So I'd like to focus on the changes from the point of view of someone like you, Jeff, someone who's here and has been here since the 80s, right, studying China.
Off and on, yeah. Mostly off, but mostly I'm off.
Maybe if you could just address two things. Can you give us just a sort of an overview of the last 30 years, the change in the amount of information available to scholars to study the Chinese environment? And then also, just as advice to our students sitting here, do you have any advice for them as what kind of skill set they need in the 21st century to address this information overflow that we have now?
Those are good questions. They're interrelated in some ways. Two things have changed in the last 25 years. Many things have changed, but two big things. One is China's place in the world and significance in the world. And you can tell that, among other things, by how often a story related to China shows up in the newspaper back in the U.S. When I was first studying China in the early 1980s, late 70s, you could go weeks easily without any story about China being in the newspaper. And when it was in the newspaper, it would probably be in the front section, the news section. Only rarely, very rarely, would there be anything about China in the business section because trade with China was so insignificant. Even more rarely would anything about China be in the sports section, with the rare exception of ping pong and the Olympics at a certain point.
No Linsanity back then. Right?
No Linsanity. And also, you wouldn't find things about China in the entertainment section often at all. That was before, and that was one of the things that first changed, I guess, with the popularity of some of Chinese filmmakers, including Zhang Yimou, back when he was celebrated as a kind of edgy independent filmmaker before he became a state choreographer in charge of things like the opening ceremony for the Olympics. But so that's one of the things that's changed is China's just now you can't go through a week without seeing a story about China in the newspaper, and you'll see stories in every possible section. So that's a change about China, even looking at a media that hasn't changed. But of course, the last 25, 30 years, a big story about change more generally has been the shift from print media to print plus online. And various new media have come and gone. In 89, one of the first years I was sort of following China intensely from afar, I studied here 86, 87, and then was finishing up a dissertation on student movements in 1989. I was looking at pre-1949 student movements, but obviously, with the 1989 ones making headlines, right. That was something I watched very intently. And at that point, a lot was made of the fact we could follow an event in China and something very much like real time because of this amazing new media called satellite television. And this was the era of CNN coming on the scene. And a lot of cameras were in China in 89, not because of the student movement, but because Gorbachev was coming to China to have a summit with Deng Xiaoping. And so the news media was present, and that was one thing that made Tiananmen such a big media event as well. Now, of course, I'm a historian, so I should say that actually there were earlier periods when new media that don't seem so new anymore to us were seen as shrinking the world and making us able to follow things in real time. Back around 1900, in the late 1800s, people were saying telegraph had completely changed the world, completely changed the sense of borders collapsing as news circulated the world at the speed of lightning. But of course, we've just been living through yet another new media revolution that has radically transformed so many things about how news circulates with the internet.
Yeah, because maybe you just focus a little bit on the internet here and also the blogs that such as that you're involved in. I remember that when we were in the 80s and 90s, if a book like, and we just were mentioning this, the Unpopular China and what was the other one? Unofficial China. By Perry Link and his comrades. It was an exciting thing to have a book about not just Chinese politics or the surface level, but what people were thinking. And now it's like it seems to me this information is not limited to one book every few years, but it's thousands and thousands of times more information every day at your fingertips. So, Jeff, is it fair to say that because of this fact of life, that the research has become more compartmentalized or more specialized because people can only cover, your blog is called the China Beat, right? Only people can only cover their certain beat, right, and not the whole of China. Is that fair to say or not?
Well, I think one of the key things is that a lot more people are studying China for a living. Mm-hmm. Now than in the 1980s, there were still a fairly small number of Americans who had been to China mm-hmm. or had gotten a degree in Chinese studies. Now there are many more, which because China's importance in the world has become impossible to ignore.
Right.
But also there's just been a maturity of the field, which leads to often a lot of specialization, which then periodically leads to a desire for integration across those specialized things. And one of the ideas of the China Beat blog, which a group of us started at Irvine, was to try to set up a way to communicate across some of the specialized lines that had emerged, including the separation between academics writing on China and journalists writing on China. So one of the first things we did, some of the academics who were writing for the blog had been interviewed by journalists. We decided we'd interview some journalists and run their responses to us. So we ran an interview very early on with Ian Johnson and with Evan Osnos.
Yeah. I think it's great. This blurring of academics and journalism is, the ideal thing. And I would consider you to be one of this new vanguard of people that you're an academic type. You're a professor, but you're also a journalist. You can't deny that.
It's okay to say that after I've gotten tenure.
Yeah.
Before I've gotten tenure, that's kind of dangerous.
Okay.
Whereas if you're a journalist, it's kind of dangerous to say you tell somebody they write like an academic. That would be seen as a problem for a journalist.
Yeah. Well, you just write very well, which is. What are you doing here in Beijing? Tell us a little bit about that.
Well, this has a lot to do with this blurring of the academic journalism divide. I've just co-edited a book with a freelance writer, journalist, Anjali Shah, and it's called Chinese Characters, Fast Changing Lives in a Fast Changing Land. Yes, characters meaning colorful individuals or individuals as opposed to the writing form that is driving some of you crazy now, probably. Right?
They're nodding frantically here. Yes, go ahead.
So this book, Chinese Characters, is a sampler of what I think of as some of the best writing on China by journalists who go deep into the culture and are interested in the kind of questions that academics might be interested in, and also some chapters by academics who have the care about writing clearly and evocatively that the best journalists have. So it's about two-thirds pieces by journalists and freelance writers and one-third by people with academic backgrounds but who are willing to check the footnotes and the specialized language at the door and just write for a general audience. It'll be out in August, and I came over in part to take part in the CET-sponsored panel at the Capital M Literary Festival in Beijing. in which we had four of the contributors to the book on stage at the same time in a session called The Art of the Profile, writing about China one life at a time. And one of the other panelists, Evan Osnos, who writes for The New Yorker, is an alum of the CET program. So that was a nice kind of tie-in. And Evan Osnos' chapter in the book, the book comes out in August, and one idea of the book was to dispel any notion that there's one kind of person in China, which since anybody who's been to China knows that would be crazy. But I still get asked sometimes when I'm back in the States, so what do the Chinese think about Barack Obama? Or what do the Chinese think about North Korea? And I'm always wanting to say, which Chinese do you mean? Do you mean people living in the countryside or living in the cities? Do you mean people living in Beijing or living in Shanghai? Because on some issues, that'll differ greatly just because the two cities have distinctive personalities. And then I'll say, you know, do you mean men or women? Do you mean people who are doing pretty well economically, not so well? Do you mean people who are about 20 or people who are about 60? Mm-hmm. And a lot of these things will just vary. So we don't want to try to come up with any magical categorization scheme or anything, but we thought by putting together 15 compelling portraits of individual Chinese with interesting lives, that this would help dispel that notion that there's any unified
great.
China.
Sounds like a great book. And that might be some contrast to the 80s when China was relatively more monochrome than it is now. You could actually say that people, you know, by and large, did think in similar ways or had exposed to the same things, right?
Right, yeah. Right.
Great. We look forward to that book. Let's go into the Lei Feng subject because that's today's Lei Feng Day, and we might as well bring it up since it's all over the news media right now. What do you make of this as a historian? I think that maybe, you know, I come from the 80s too in China, and maybe you share my sentiment that back then I don't think we would have predicted that Lei Feng would still be this big in the 21st century. That's a little bizarre. What do you make of all this?
Well, I think if Lei, we would have imagined, I'd say another step, we would have imagined that if Lei Feng were still relevant at all, China wouldn't have changed that much. Mm. And so what's disorienting,
yes,
I think, for people,
yes,
like us is to see that in some ways China has changed in unimaginable from those time days. And just for the younger people in the room, a Chinese city was one of the most boring places in the world to live in the mid-1980s. Shanghai, which is, it has 50,000 plus restaurants now. It had about five in the mid-1980s that other than, you know, work unit cafeterias and things like that. And it was a big deal when one foreign movie would come through. And there weren't the black market knockoffs of other movies. My wife and I brought like 25 cassette tapes because we knew that would be the music that we had for the year.
Right.
And at that point, and this is one of the most striking things, when we would meet people in our mid-20s, and we got to be very good friends with some. These were people who had grown up. We had nothing in common when it came to, we hadn't watched any of the same entertainment while growing up. We hadn't listened to any of the same music. We hadn't played any of the same games, really. So we had to sort of overcome this enormous chasm when it came to popular culture that now it's a totally different world where you come over from the U.S. and you play World of Warcraft and you meet somebody who plays World of Warcraft. They've seen Friends, if they're of a certain urban type, and you would have seen more Chinese movies in the reverse that way. You know, it's not balanced, but it's that. So we would think, you know, if Lei Feng is still relevant, surely not much about China's enmeshment with the world and values or anything would have changed. And yet, China's changed enormously, but then there are these odd moments of kind of throwbacks to something that really should have outlived its day, having a new revival. And maybe some of it with Lei Feng is something that the rapid change leads to a kind of sense of alienation, confusion. And so there's this desire to grab onto things from the past that might seem to suggest some kind of purity. And nostalgia movements work that way in many places.
And the party is grappling with some kind of the values issues and values crisis.
Right, this idea that China's become too selfish and too materialistic, so throwing back there. A few years ago, Confucius was seen as maybe that is the place to reach back to sort of say what a sort of purer, grander version of Chineseness is. And what's so really weird about this is if you reach back to the Mao period, at the same time you're reaching back to Confucius. During the Mao period, Confucius was blamed for everything that was wrong with China. So I could really imagine, I haven't seen this, somebody saying, learn from Lei Feng and Confucius. And, you know, in the 60s, you sort of chose. If you were on Taiwan, it was learn from Confucius. Mm. On the mainland, it was learn from Lei Feng. These didn't blend together or roll together the way they do in China now.
China continues to confound, evidently. All right, let's get to our student questions here. We have four very bright, eager people waiting to ask you questions. Why don't we start with you, Brandon, because you have seniority here. You've been here with the program longest. So tell us your name, where you're from. If you want to tell us why you're here in China, go ahead, but then ask your question.
My name is Brandon Furdock. I'm from Kalamazoo College in Michigan. And I came to China to learn Chinese, and I've always had an interest in the culture. And so I've been wondering, when talking about emerging superpowers in the 21st century, I think two names that often come up are China, of course, and also India. And I was wondering if you could talk maybe briefly on the relationship China and India have, and maybe how China as a nation views India, if they're afraid maybe, or they think it's a great possible partner in the future.
That's a wonderful question. I'll begin with the kind of back to the 80s thing again. When I was studying China in the early 1980s, a lot of people said to me, shouldn't you really be studying Japan? They're the country that's really going to be significant to us economically. They're the booming economy. And at that point, if you'd said, where's an Asian superpower going to come from? People would have said Japan. But you're right that now, even though Japan's still major, major economy, there's now this fascination with the China-India thing, in part because of the size of the two countries. I had my first opportunity to go to India just for a week a year and a half ago. And one thing that was striking is there's intense, intense interest in and curiosity and worry about China in India. There's much less of it flowing the other direction. So I think if you think of the nervousness, it's disproportionately on the Indian side for a variety of reasons. One is that India depends on it for its water. A lot of the water comes from the Himalayan glaciers, and so China controls the land that has that where the water can go. So there's worry about that. But in general, there's also just this sense, there was the Olympics were a defining moment here. When Americans watched the Olympics, the opening ceremony, there was sort of a question because they were such a wow event. The American question was, can we still do something like that? Or has our day passed? In India, it was sort of, can we ever do something? Can we ever get to the point to do something like that? And so that's a different sort of getting at that. I do actually find the similarities. A lot of times the two countries are held up as contrasts because India has elections and China has, as the Financial Times correspondent Richard McGregor puts it, China doesn't have elections, it has selections. And there's a difference there. But I do think that so in India there's this idea that maybe the reason China can develop faster is because it has this kind of efficient form of authoritarianism. And there's the worry that maybe the kind of democracy is kind of inefficient. But the other thing I would just say is that if you get away from just what the contrast, there are also some similarities. Both have anger at corruption is one of the biggest issues in both the countries, despite how different the political systems are. Thanks.
Okay. Lana, you want to go?
Hi, my name is Lana, and I'm from New York. What I'm wondering today is, as China begins to move past its economic miracle, and as the price of China begins to go up in terms of labor costs, and as workers become more aware of their rights, what do you see replacing this economic miracle in China? Many other countries have gone through this economic phase and then have filtered into service sectors or innovative technology sectors. What do you see replacing China
in terms of
economic miracle?
That's a great question, and that's the kind of question I'm nervous about because I'm not an economist. I know what the Chinese government is trying to do there, and one of the things they're trying to do is extend the period of China's boom by turning to internal domestic consumption. And say that even if it gets priced out of some export markets, if there are more and more Chinese who are rising, buying more and more things, that can keep some of the production of goods. clearly some industries will migrate out of China to places where labor is cheaper and maybe workers are even more exploited, though they're still pretty badly exploited in the U.S. and in China in lots of ways. In the long term, there has to be some new formula. The question is, what economists argue about, and this is where I don't feel like I know enough to get into it, and I don't have a dog in this fight, is how much time they have. The other big problem with China is the aging population, and that puts a real pressure on it. One thing that I think economists and all forecasters have a hard time with China about is we just haven't seen any other country go through quite the same set of moves that China has. Just the combination. You can point to any one factor and say that's like X or that's like Y. You can look at Singapore, which had a kind of controlled society and culture, one-party state. It didn't automatically democratize as it got richer. The Chinese government is looking at Singapore a lot as one potential model they have for the last 20 years. But we just don't know. We haven't seen a country this big go through the kinds of things it's going through, so it's unclear. Singapore might not be a good model because it's small, but South Korea might not be the obvious model either because it's very different in size and diversity.
Okay, next.
Hi, I'm Raymond. I'm from Connecticut College in Connecticut. my question was a bit different from the other two. I was thinking about the bigger picture as well. But I just wanted to ask you, what have you noticed in the past 30 years interacting with, you know, a lot of Chinese people? And you've already talked about how there are a lot of characters in China. Have you noticed any differences in how the Chinese view themselves, how they view the world? Because I remember a lot of professors back at home, Chinese professors, tell me about how when they were young and they were coming to the U.S., the U.S. was the place to go. And, you know, they had this kind of national, you know, sentiment attached to them that I'm studying in the U.S., I'm a representative of China. But then they talk about how the Chinese kids now are really well-traveled. They've been to the seven continents before they come to the U.S. They speak English fluently. And so I've been kind of wondering what you've taken from the 30 years that you've been here about how that's changed, how the Chinese character, if you may, has changed.
Yeah, that's certainly something that's changed dramatically. I much more rarely meet somebody who seems kind of starstruck at the idea of being able to talk to somebody from America. Mm-hmm. There's been a real sense of America being a somewhat more ordinary place. Mm-hmm. I now have more, I segue into talking about being from California, which sometimes people have a more distinct view of and sometimes more positive one in China because there's been a fair amount of connection between the two places. So more knowledge of America has meant a somewhat more differentiated view of us. But the traveling is, it's the boom in travel, both internationally and domestically. It was rare when I was here in the 1980s, sometimes I had seen much more of China than most of the people I knew who were Chinese had seen because I had traveled around to six or seven cities. And now travel, this is a form of leisure activity, has become much more common for the segment of the Chinese population that's doing pretty well economically. We need to always bracket that off. So I think this physically traveling to different parts of the world is a big story about change in China, but also virtual travel, being exposed to many more images of the other world, the other parts of the world, not the other world.
it's Freudian slip, but that's kind
is.
Of appropriate.
There it is. It may be. You know, in the same way that when I first went to China, I hadn't been exposed to that many images of it. I just hadn't, I couldn't Google the university I was going to be staying at. I'd never seen a picture of the university I was going to and things like that. Yeah. So again, this is one thing where the media, I think people are growing up around the world with at least the possibility of more knowledge, even if it's a fairly superficial knowledge, but a knowledge of many different parts of the world. And that's certainly been true of China as well. There is still sometimes it intersects with nationalism. This was something else you were saying. It intersects with nationalism and a sense of national pride in very complicated ways. But that would be a whole podcast on its own. Yeah.
Okay. And final question.
Hi, my name is Catherine Watts from the University of Virginia in Charlottesville, Virginia. And my question for you today is, as a historian, what would you say are the major historical influences that has made China what it is today? As, you know, major economic power, you know, the people that have that are, you know, walking today and everything. Mm-hmm.
That's a really big, big question to think about.
It's the right guy to ask, too. This is exactly his.
How do I do this?
It's his.
One of the things that that makes China what it is today, I'll take some of the things that maybe aren't as obvious, but well, one of the things that I always say is that history isn't what happened in the past. History is the stories we tell about what happened in the past. So one of the stories that I think is incredibly influential on China today is the story of the so-called 100 years of humiliation, when China, which had been the most important country in the part of the world that anybody in China cared about, had been true up to the 1800s, was defeated in wars by countries that they thought of as minor, insignificant, barbarian groups. So when the British defeated China in the Opium War, it was a real psychic blow to that. And then during the course of the 1840s to the 1940s, China continued to be pushed around and carved up in part by different foreign powers. And that had a tremendous effect on changing China, in part because the Communist Party rose to power, in part because it was communist. I mean, it promised certain economic changes that we associate with communism, but in part because it was nationalistic, because it said, we are the organization devoted to standing up against foreign bullying. The so-called Nationalist Party of Chiang Kai-shek, which had nationalism in its title, they said had been too willing to accommodate to foreign powers. So the Communist Party rose to power in part because of its gaining adherence during anti-imperialist, anti-foreign movements. So that period had a lot to do with shaping China. But recently, the last 20 years or so, when the Communist Party faced a crisis of faith in the communist side of its belief system, in part because it was abandoning so much focus on equality of economics, they've emphasized this kind of 100 years of national humiliation, insisting that people remember and focus on it. And so that's a part of the past that was both important when it actually happened, and then it has important in a different way by the kind of obsessive focus on it there. And, you know, this is not unique to China. The Boston Tea Party wasn't all that important when it happened, but it became important in the stories that people told about it later. And then it took on a new lease of life it was sometimes used as a symbol for the left in America. Recently it's been used as a symbol by the right, and it kind of has this new meaning. There are other things for both better and worse. Mao, as a distinctive historical figure, had a big influence on China that we just can't get away from. Both really brutal impact through the purges and the disastrous policies of the Great Leap Forward that led to this largest famine of peacetime in the world. But he also had an impact on even the economic boom that happened after his death. We often think of China as moving on a new path after Mao, which they did. But Mao, while the period of his rule, 1949 to 1976, was filled with these very disruptive events, some of which were disastrous, he did introduce social welfare programs of a sort that meant that after he died, China, and this is a contrast with India, China had this enormous population that was largely literate, with a high percentage of literacy compared to any other developing country, and a workforce that was in relatively good health. Life expectancies were rising. So when a new set of economic policies were ready to come in with this labor force left over from the Mao years, that was part of what was the combination that allowed China to rise.
Okay. take that home and digest it. Boy, I wish you could teach my class. I think we're going to talk tomorrow about Yuan Ming Yuan, right? Mm-hmm. So, oh, I wish Jeff, come teach my class tomorrow.
I'll have to be on a plane back to
Yeah, home. Sorry. Okay, well, I'll do my best then. Well, I guess we have to wrap it up for this installment of the podcast. Remember, the title of it is a CET in China, A Bridge to the Future. Stay tuned for more podcasts. I'll talk with various other Chinese experts, journalists, old China hands. Not that you're an old China hand. You're a
middle-aged China hand. Yes. Okay. Yeah.
And as always, thanks to David Lancashire, our own Lei Feng out there, and the pop-up Chinese studios. They've got some of the best Chinese language learning stuff on the internet.
I agree.
And they've got an ongoing CET module on their site, so check that out. And thanks again, Jeff, for your time coming
here.
It's
been my pleasure. Thanks for the good questions.
Yeah, thanks to the students here. And this is David Moser in Beijing. Bye for now.